Philippians 1, we're going to start partway into verse 18. It's printed in your bulletin if you have it. Yes, and I will rejoice, for I know that through your prayers and the help of the Spirit of Jesus Christ, this will turn out for my deliverance. As it is my eager expectation and hope that I will not be at all ashamed, but that with full courage now as always, Christ will be honored in my body, whether by life or by death. For to me to live is Christ and to die is gain. If I'm to live in the flesh, that means fruitful labor for me, yet which I shall choose, I cannot tell. I'm hard pressed between the two. My desire is to depart and be with Christ, for that is far better. But to remain in the flesh is more necessary on your account. Convinced of this, I know that I will remain and continue with you all for your progress and joy in the faith, so that in me you may have ample cause to glory in Christ Jesus, because of my coming to you again. Only let your manner of life be worthy of the gospel of Christ, so that whether I come and see you or am absent, I may hear of you that you are standing firm in one spirit with one mind, striving side by side for the faith of the gospel, and not frightened in anything by your opponents. This is a clear sign to them of their destruction, but of your salvation, and that from God. For it has been granted to you that for the sake of Christ you should not only believe in Him, but also suffer for His sake, engaged in the same conflict that you saw I had and now hear that I still have. This is God's Word. You may be seated. Some of you may be aware that May 24th is going to be the season finale, the series finale of the television show 24. 24 chronicles and has chronicled over 8 seasons the terrorist thwarting adventures of Jack Bauer, played by Kiefer Sutherland. And each season covers a single 24-hour period in Jack's life and consistently takes the idea of having a bad day to whole new levels. In a typical episode, Jack faces ethical dilemmas such as, is it okay to make deals with drug lords to avert nuclear holocaust? Can you shoot the family members of terrorists to foil their plots? And one which may resonate a little closer to home, is it okay to kill innocent co-workers if it's in the vital strategic interest of the United States of America? These are ethical dilemmas which I'm sure many of us feel very close to home and face every day. I'm grateful that Jack Bauer leads us through them. But one thing that I always appreciate about the show, even though I have to admit I dropped out after season 6, it just wore me out, is that 24 kind of takes us out of the humdrum routine of cubicles and commutes and classrooms. And in contemporary suburban America, it's so easy for us to sort of ghettoize death, to sanitize life so that we never see death and dying. It's all in hospitals or retirement homes. It's far away from our everyday experience. In 24, death is always lurking right around the corner. A typical scene, which probably recurs several times each season, goes something like this. Terrorist threatens a civilian. Arm this nuclear weapon or I kill you. Audience, of course, yells at the TV, don't do it, he'll kill you anyway. Civilian arms a nuclear weapon. Terrorist kills a civilian. And you say, I told you so. But not that that's light viewing, but here's what I find that's so compelling about such scenes. Most of the time, and I can't say this always, but most of the time, 24 does a good job of avoiding glamorizing or glossing over death, as so many action shows do. In 24, you see it in so many characters. Death is frightening, and it's ugly, and it's scary. It's an ironic instance of entertainment actually calling us back out of a sanitized world to our sanitized world of, as I said before, cubicles, commutes, and classrooms, to face stark questions of life and of death. In our passage this morning, we see that Paul himself is confronted perhaps with a slightly less action-oriented situation, but nonetheless a question, a matter, a situation that's a life or death situation. And as he reacts to this situation, what we see, Paul doesn't dwell a lot in this particular passage about what the gospel is. like he does so richly, and you're going to see so powerfully in chapter 2 when we talk about the lordship of Christ over all things, or chapter 3 talking about how the gospel is that God gives righteousness to people that cannot earn it for themselves so that they can be welcomed into God's presence. This section of chapter 1 is more about the effects of the gospel, the impact that the gospel has on matters of life and on matters of death. So there's actually two chunks in here. The first we're going to look at is Paul commands a gospel-worthy approach to life, and Paul commands a gospel-worthy approach to death. A gospel-worthy approach to life and a gospel-worthy approach to death. The first actually is in the second section of this passage. We're going to look first at verses 27 through 30 because here Paul is actually transitioning. He's going to talk about what it looks like to have, as he says in verse 27, for your manner of life to be worthy of the gospel of Christ. And he gives several marks. There's three in this little paragraph, and actually he rolls on in chapter 2. He's going to have several more. And so I want to look at this section first because Paul hits these points very quickly, and we're just going to hit them very quickly this morning. First, gospel-worthy living is consistent. In verse 27, Paul says, whether I come and see you or am absent, I want to hear that you are standing firm. Paul wants the Philippians to live out a life based on the gospel, whether he's there or not, whether or not they have the apostle looking over hit their shoulder. I believe that one of the posters in the cafeteria last time I was with you, I saw, says that character is what you do when no one's looking. I think Paul would probably modify it a little bit because those who really grasp the gospel, or perhaps more accurately have been grasped by it, don't live to please their boss, their family, even their pastor, but they live to please Jesus, and so even when no one is looking, they strive to be consistent because they want to please the God who loves them. Second, gospel-worthy living breeds unity. Continuing in verse 27, Paul says, may I hear of you that you are standing firm in one spirit, with one mind, striving side by side for the faith of the gospel. Christian unity should mark all of our relationships with brothers and sisters in Christ, in the faith. As Harry said last week, passion for the gospel binds you to other believers. This applies whether it's, you know, just sort of our everyday relationships with one another. You'll see this later in chapter 4 where Paul appeals to Euodia and Syntyche to agree in the Lord. And it also applies in our broader relationships within and among different congregations and denominations. The gospel calls individuals into a church to agree with one another, and it also calls churches and groups of churches to coordinate and work together for the sake of the gospel. That's what presbytery is that Harry talked about just a moment. That's what many of the larger organizations of denominations and other such organizations are for. But keep in mind here that for Paul, unity is the fruit of gospel-worthy living, gospel-worthy life. If some Christians put too little emphasis upon this fruit of the gospel, others put so much that unity eclipses the gospel. Both of these are problems. The unity of Paul, the unity that Paul urges in verse 27 is what he says, for the faith of the gospel. Just to briefly give you a couple of guidelines before we roll on. In chapter 1, Paul rejoices that Christ is being preached, even though he suspects and seems like he knows that Christ is being preached from wrong motives. Christ is being preached to sort of compete with Paul. And yet, even though he knows the motives are wrong and may be twisted, he rejoices because the message is on target. So as long as Jesus, his salvation that he has wrought, his resurrection, the hope of his return, as long as the message of the gospel is preached and the message is on target, he rejoices in a unity, even with those who perhaps in their heart aren't unified with Paul. But in chapter 3, the situation with the circumcision party is very different. One of the struggles in the early church is that there are two different groups. There's Jews and Gentiles, two very different cultures in one church. And the circumcision party has a solution to this cultural difference. It's unity. Let's make everyone Jews. That will solve it. And Paul says that's not gospel unity. That's an ethnic unity, It's a cultural unity. To be a little bit crass, it's just foreskin unity. God doesn't care about it. And in fact, when it displaces unity around Christ and who Jesus is, God actually hates it. Gospel unity clusters around no one other than Jesus, the Jesus of Philippians 2, the Jesus who was equal to God, who humbled himself to the point of death, and now is risen and exalted at the right hand of the Father as Lord over all creation. He is the center of true gospel unity. And finally, suffering and conflict are an unavoidable mark of gospel-worthy living. It's very tempting for preachers and teachers to try to shade off this part of what the Bible teaches. It's very tempting for me to stand up here and to want to sort of sell you on the gospel and say, there's all these great things that will flow out of being a follower of Jesus. And there are lots of great things that flow out of being a follower of Jesus. But it's not all great, especially in this life. In the words of one preacher, he says, it's very tempting for churches to preach that if you believe in Jesus, you won't have to live like Jesus. If you believe in Jesus, you won't have to live like Jesus. But Paul, when he preaches the gospel, says Christians will suffer just like Jesus. Christianity is both optimistic about the future, but also realistic about the continuing presence of sin in the present. Paul isn't just realistic about suffering. In fact, he says that suffering is granted to the Philippians. It's a gift to the Philippians. We think that all pain is bad. Take it away. Get rid of it. But suffering can also be, not necessarily, as I mentioned earlier, not necessarily a good in itself, but God's means of redemption. That's what Jesus' cross was. It wasn't good in itself, but suffering turned for redemption. And in fact, God uses suffering to teach us a lot about himself. Since it's Mother's Day, let me illustrate with one conversation that I had, which I think resonates with some other women. I knew one new mom who was very successful, really smart. She was in a graduate program in the sciences, which itself is, the sciences are actually one of the harder disciplines for women to advance far in. And she told me that following the birth of her daughter, and she was taking time off to take care of her daughter, this woman who had sort of very expansive intellectual interest and loved studying the world, she felt like every day there was less of me and more of her, the baby. Her world was getting smaller and smaller and smaller. But you know what? That gives you a little glimpse into what God has done, what Jesus did in coming to work salvation. Compared to the glories of heaven, his world became incredibly small. His world became as small as the baby that's in the sling that Rebecca is wearing. The king of the universe ended up, when he was grown, trekking around dusty hillsides in Palestine. And so when our world is constricting, whether it's through motherhood or various other things, we have a little image, we have a little reminder of what Jesus was willing to undergo for our sakes. Some moms, on the other hand, you watch your children and you have a godly desire to parent them well, and you may see things come out of their hearts, and what you see come out of their hearts breaks your heart. Selfishness, anger, pride, and they can't even speak yet. Well, again, that's a little picture of how God looks on us, his children, that there's so many ugly things that come out of our hearts that break his heart. God can use suffering to teach us more about himself. And these are some aspects of suffering that flow from life in a fallen world, but this passage is especially focused on suffering for the sake of Christ. And many of us don't realize it, until we become Christians, but we do live in a war zone. God has enemies, and so when God in the gospel takes us out of a kingdom of darkness and brings us into a kingdom of light, it's glorious and we rejoice, but all of a sudden we have a whole bunch of enemies that weren't our enemies before. If we suffer for his sake, it's actually God's gift to us because it's confirming that while the world is in rebellion against God, he has brought us, he has changed our allegiance. Sometimes it feels like in the kingdom of darkness, you know, I get to be, you know, there might have been a battle going on, but I got to be way back with the supplies. It was kind of comfortable and quiet. And now I feel like in this, I switch sides and now I'm on the front lines and like bullets are whizzing over my head. But believing in Jesus does not exempt us from living like him, and suffering for his sake confirms that God has called us to himself and He has changed our allegiance, and that there is a battle going on, and that He has brought you graciously to His side. Consistency, unity, and suffering. These are three marks of gospel-worthy living. You're going to see some more going on in chapter 2, but now I want to back up for a minute, because, first I want to say this. The good news of the gospel, we've been talking about gospel-worthy living, gospel-worthy lifestyle. Just to make very clear, gospel-worthy living and a gospel-worthy lifestyle is not itself the gospel. I mentioned this already. These are fruits of the gospel. These flow out of the gospel. The gospel is not that Jesus has given us three habits of highly spiritual people. Gospel-worthy living does not earn participation in the gospel. In chapter 1, verse 6 that you looked at last week, Paul reminds us that it's God who begins His good work in us and will bring it to completion. Gospel-worthy living is a response. It's a result. It flows out of the gospel. And the other result of the gospel that we see in the first section of this passage, which we'll now look at, is that the gospel leads to the result of a gospel-worthy approach to death. A gospel-worthy approach to death, in the face of death. It's helpful to know, we kind of jumped in, I should have given you a little bit of context before reading at verse 18. It's helpful to know a little bit of the context of what's going on. What's Paul's situation? Why is it so perilous? For Paul, being in prison is not anything particularly new. He's kind of used to it. Almost everywhere he goes, Paul's preaching would have had two results. There's almost always one group who says, this is glorious good news, and so they become Christians and they start churches. But there's almost always another group who say, this is terrible news, I reject this for whatever reason. And pretty soon you see that they're kicking up like public disturbances and riots. And so usually Paul ends up in prison until the authorities sort out what happened. Almost always Paul is exonerated. But what's happened is that eventually Paul's enemies, those who are opposed to the gospel, decide that they've had enough of this cycle. Paul keeps getting off. We're going to have to take matters into our own hands. So Paul gets arrested in Palestine, right near Jerusalem. Actually, in Jerusalem is where he's arrested. Excuse me. And they decide, we can't risk it. He keeps getting let off. So his enemies decide what they're going to do is, let's try to set a trial date at the local municipal court. And, he's probably going to get off again. So what we do is, on the way there, let's just ambush him and kill him and have done with it, right? So they're trying to set up this trial date and take advantage of it for their own purposes. To avoid this ambush, Paul takes advantage of his rights as a Roman citizen, and he appeals to Caesar. He appeals to a higher court. I don't want to go to the municipal court. It's a good strategy, really. Jerusalem is east, Rome is west. He's going to go the other direction from the ambush. And what happens is that now, as he writes Philippians, he's waiting for his trial in Rome, and he is under house arrest. He's probably actually chained to a Roman soldier at all times. This is no doubt how the gospel, it says in chapter 1, verse 13, the gospel has become known throughout the whole imperial guard. That's because Paul can't, he just keeps yapping about it every shift change, right? The next guy comes and he's, oh, you want to know what I was talking about to the last guy? And so this is, what Paul is experiencing as he's waiting for his trial date. Every lower level political authority and legal authority who has heard his case has said, Paul hasn't done anything wrong. This isn't a big deal. He should be able to get off. So he just needs to go have his case heard and he'll be let off. And in verses 25 and 26, Paul seems pretty confident that he'll win his case. He's not only confident of the result, but he's sort of making plans to come see the Philippians. So you might ask, what's the big deal? Why is this life or death? Well, there's just a couple of catches. The first one is that when you appeal to Caesar, there's no appeals court above him. His decision is going to be final. If you have a bad day, if things don't go your way, there's no do-over. So that wouldn't in itself be that bad of a thing if Caesar were reliable, but unfortunately right now, Caesar happens to be Nero. This makes things, if you know your classical history, this makes things interesting. There are stories, some of you are going to love this illustration, there are stories that when Steve Jobs returned to run Apple the second time, employees would avoid riding the elevator with him because if he sort of started chatting with you and he decided, you know what, that project's worthless, you might be fired by the time you got to your floor. And if you're a Microsoft fan, you probably love that I just compared Steve Jobs to Nero, but here's the big difference. Steve Jobs would fire you, Nero would light you on fire in his garden to light up his dinner party. He's kind of twisted. Nero will never make it onto a Mother's Day card, or he should never make it onto a Mother's Day card. The long, long list of people he had executed included, you guessed it, his mom. Oh my goodness. And so while Paul's hopeful based on the merits of his case, on the wrong day with Nero as the judge, the merits of the case might not really matter all that much, right? So Paul's trial really is a life or death situation. He can't be entirely sure that Nero's going to judge in his favor or judge justly. There's just enough doubt about the verdict for him to seriously ponder the different possible outcomes. He may be acquitted or he may be executed, and if he's executed, it will probably be very painful. But in the face of this, Paul's faith in the gospel, again, results of the gospel, produces three surprising convictions. Three surprising convictions. The first one we see is that Paul, when you read this passage, he doesn't seem to care what happens. I mean, this is a little bit surprising. If you start reading verse 19, he talks about how he's sure that between the prayers of the Philippians and the Holy Spirit, this will turn out for my deliverance. And we think, okay, he knows he's going to get off. But if you keep reading, you realize that for him, deliverance doesn't mean I know I'm going to get off. It doesn't mean I know I'm going to win the case. In verse 20, Paul's hope is that I know it's going to be for my deliverance. I will not be at all ashamed, but with full courage, now as always, I know that Christ will be honored in my body, whether by life or by death. You know, Paul doesn't seem to care. It's sort of like, I may live, I may die, but my joy and my confidence is that Christ will be honored through me. I don't know about you, but that's not usually the way I'm wired. You know, I develop very strong opinions. It doesn't have to be life or death. It can be what our plan is for the afternoon. And I develop a strong opinion. If the things don't go my way, I'm not thinking about Christ being honored in my changed afternoon plan. I'm getting frustrated and bent out of shape. But something about the gospel has grasped Paul and needs to and can grasp us, because when we come to understand something about God and His work in Jesus, it profoundly relativizes even the greatest fears, the greatest challenges, the greatest disappointments in life. I'm almost tempted to call this gospel indifference, except that Paul isn't just indifferent to everything. He's indifferent to his circumstances. The reason he's indifferent to his circumstances is because he knows that Jesus can turn any circumstance in his life and in the life of his people to Jesus' own glory. It's less that Jesus makes us indifferent, it's more that he causes us to so love his name and his honor and his glory that it eclipses anything else that might happen. I'll come back to this in chapter 4, and you'll study this in future weeks. But in our lives, this Spirit worked. Sanctified indifference to circumstances, it could take lots of ways. It could sound something like, God, whether I find a job or not, my joy and my confidence is that either way, Christ will be honored through me. God, you may grant children or you may not, but either way, my joy and confidence is Christ will be honored through me. God, you may grant me a spouse or not, but either way, my joy and confidence is that Christ will be honored through me. As one brother who was an incredible testimony to the power of the gospel said to me repeatedly, I would talk to him on the phone, he would say, God, the cancer may disappear, then the cancer may come back, but I rejoice, I'm confident that Christ will be honored through me either way. He was an incredible brother gripped by the gospel. That's the first surprising conviction. It's a sanctified indifference to circumstances. The second is this. For Paul, he says, he seems not to care, but he said, okay, if I have to pick, what am I going to pick, right? If you have to pick life and death, what are you going to probably pick? Well, Paul says, I think I'll go with death. For Paul, death is better than life. Now, Paul isn't being morbid. He's not being suicidal. That's not what's behind this. Because for Paul, death is an oblivion. It's not an escape from pain. What he says in verse 21 is this. He says, to die is gain. And verse 23, my desire is to depart. Why? To be with Christ. For that is far better. The Bible provides some moving pictures of what life after death will be like, and especially what the renewal of all things will be like in the new heavens and the new earth. And I suspect that many of those pictures are more like impressionist paintings than photographs. They have glorious pictures of the future. Jesus tells us in one place that that the Father's mansion will have many rooms. He says that will be a place free of tears, that will be like a city with golden street, with a water, with a river of water that will be for the healing of the nations. Glorious picture of the future. And yet in the midst of all that, what grasps and holds Paul is this, that he wants to go to the new heavens and the new earth. He wants to be in heaven because he wants to be, what? With Jesus. Because that's the center of that vision. He wants to be with Jesus. There's really a couple surprising things here, because at one level, Paul is looking at death. And in a culture and society and in hearts which fear what comes after death, because apart from Jesus, nobody's come back and told us what's going to happen. Into the face of what's uncertainty for so many, Paul says, I'm not uncertain. I saw Jesus standing in front of me. He came back. And I know that he's going to give me life on the other side. The other really surprising thing about that is that, if you do think about your relationship with God, on what foundation do you say that I know death is better because I know that God will have me? That I know that God will have me. If we're really honest, we have to say that it's not based on anything that we can say that we've done. And so that's another part of why Paul is so eager to pass through death into the new life with Christ, because he knows that Christ will have him. He knows it's not because he's been such a good apostle. You know, he already tried that when he was persecuting the church, and Jesus said, why are you persecuting me? He knows it's not because of how well he's done in his life, but he knows that Jesus will have him because Jesus has given him the benefits of Jesus' own life, and Jesus has taken on himself on the cross the guilt of his own sin. I used to love comic books, and there's one that was back in the 90s called Madman Comics, and Madman has this near-death experience, and then is very self-reflective in the comic book about life and death matters. And one thing he talks about is infinity, bigness, the idea of living forever. It's so big, it's kind of scary. Do you ever feel that? Where just big things, like you start thinking about the universe and vast distances between stars, and bigness has sort of a terrifying effect on us. I think that's because we're small, we're finite. We're supposed to be a little bit terrified of big things, because especially in our sin, we're facing an infinite big God. And apart from something that removes that sin, it is fearful to face our infinite God. And yet, here's the thing, he's sort of reflecting on, is heaven a good idea? Like, living forever, it just sounds so long, it's kind of scary. And then he says, wait a minute, you know, he has a love interest, Joe, and he's like, wait a minute, it would be okay to live forever if I was with Joe. I really love Joe, and if I were with her, forever wouldn't be long enough. And I think that's what's the heart of what Paul is saying in this passage. If I'm going to be with Jesus, forever's not going to be long enough. I know he loves me, and I love him because he loved me first. Paul desires to be with Christ rather than to be with Christ and to enjoy full life rather than just sort of the half life of this life. And yet, Paul kind of, you know, yanks us like a yo-yo here. He says, "Well, I don't really care, but if I got to choose, I'll take death." But then he says, "No, hold on. Let me think about this again." Because for Paul, the primary question is not, you know, what do I want most? Paul doesn't turn around and say, well, I want death, so let's see if I can get myself killed. You know, I could intentionally flub my case, and then I get to be with Jesus. What controls Paul is that I want to do what Jesus wants me to do. And so he says, I know that Jesus wants me to serve the churches as long as he gives me life. And so what he says is that as long as Jesus gives me life, I want to do what Jesus wants me to do. And so, you know what? I'd rather be with Jesus if it were just my own choice, but I want to do what Jesus wants to do. So, okay, no, I switch my vote. I'm going to live. I'd like to live. And he says it not because he's scared of death, but because he wants to serve. For Paul, his final surprising conviction is that service trumps self-interest, even the self-interest of glory with Jesus. It will come in time. Paul says in verse 22, if I'm to live in the flesh, that means fruitful labor for me. So in verse 23, he says, my desire is to depart and be with Christ, for that is far better. Verse 24, to remain in the flesh is more necessary on your account. and convinced of this, I know that I will remain and continue with you all for your progress and your joy in the faith. These three surprising convictions, a Christ-centered indifference to circumstances, a preference for the life to come, and a principled self-denial of even the greatest of joys for a time in order to serve others, these are gospel-rooted convictions that transform people and communities and nations. One of the best illustrations of the transformative power of such commitments comes from a book that I read called The Rise of Christianity. It's by Rodney Stark. It's a fabulous book. If you're a reader, this is a book to read. Starting one of the sections, he talks about plagues and the impact of plagues on the church and the Roman Empire in the first couple centuries of the existence of the church. And in about 165, and then again in 250, there were two epidemics that swept through Rome. I mean, these were devastating. Mortality rates were probably 25 to 30% of the population. People who wrote about it said, this is like the plague on Egypt where the firstborn in every house died, but if only it had been only that bad, because most houses have more than one. And in the midst of this, you know, looking back, people have guessed this probably was just simple stuff like smallpox and measles, but people in Europe had not been exposed to that for a number of years, and so it was devastating. And while the Romans understood human anatomy, this is about the extent of their knowledge of how germs worked. Sick people made other people sick, so you should stay away from them. That was about it. And so the result, as these epidemics swept through and struck houses, the result was that anybody who could got out of town. There's the top surgeon in classical Rome was named Galen, incredibly advanced thinker. And everybody have sort of commented on how Galen's account of these epidemics that occurred in his lifetime, remarkably sketchy. So for such a good doctor, he doesn't seem to know what he's talking about. And it's not all surprising because he did what most sensible and wealthy Romans did. He got out of town. He took a vacation. No doctoring for me right now. Pagans fled plague-stricken cities and one another to avoid death. But in the midst of this is where the results of the gospel were manifested. Because what happened is that Christians, with these three heart attitudes, with a gospel-worthy faith approach to death and a gospel-worthy approach to life, they acted very differently. They stayed with their friends. They stayed with their families. They stayed with fellow believers. And they stayed with their neighbors. And they took care of them. Because service trumped self-interest. They had a holy indifference to life or death. And they knew that the plague, if it did take them, the new life with Jesus that awaited them would be better. What they believed mattered to how they lived. And the best part of the story, I think, is that how God's sort of supernatural purposes intertwine with his natural purposes, because people look back now and they say, oh, you know, now we realize that actually if you just do basic nursing in the midst of an epidemic, if you don't run away, but you actually come and you take care of somebody and give them water and food, the mortality rate plummets. And so because Christians were able to risk their lives, their fellow Christians, their family members, their neighbors were much more likely to survive. And it was an incredible testimony to the gospel. In fact, these two plagues were key to Christianity becoming the dominant religious force within three centuries in the greatest empire in the world at that time, from a group of 120 people in an upper room. It was because Christians set aside fear of death, served one another, and were motivated by their knowledge that what came after life was better than life itself. It was an incredible testimony to a watching world. In the last section of this, when Paul's talking about unity, he talks about, he says that the unity, and I want to sort of stretch this out to all of these marks, these results of gospel living, that unity was a clear sign to them, the opponents of the gospel, of their destruction, but of salvation that comes from God. Last week, as we were getting ready to go to the hospital to pick up our son, it was so dusty. We're down in Atlantic City, and there was so much pollen that was coming off the trees. I was packing the car at the hotel, and I could see whirlwinds of pollen going by. If you have allergies, like, you're probably sniffling just thinking about this. And as we were driving home, we could see billows of pollen coming off the clouds. And I was thinking about how Jesus says that the gospel, the work of the Spirit, is like wind. You hear it, and you can't see the wind itself, but you can see its effect. You can see even sometimes the shape of the wind by the things it's blowing away around, even though you can't see it itself. And Paul is saying here that the gospel, Jesus is Lord, He gives us life, He gives us hope of resurrection so that we share it with Him. That changes the way we live, and it changes our approach to life, and you can see it in the life of God's people.